Welcome to Chopping It Up, the podcast discussing horror movies new and old. I'm Jesse, and I'm joined by my fellow co-host, Joel and Michael. Together, we'll compare and contrast two horror movies, connecting them via various through lines, including themes, tropes, motifs, actors, and subgenres, among other similarities. The goal is to explore the evolution of the horror genre, and to compare and contrast how these films interact with each other, and where they sit in the cinematic landscape. Each episode will cover everything, including remakes, sequels, reimaginations, and reboots of classic films, from slasher flicks to vampire movies, to zombie movies, to Lovecraftian films, to monster movies, to psychological horror, to just about anything else you can think of. Thanks for joining us. Now, let's get started discussing, or as they say, chopping it up. Welcome to episode one of Chopping It Up. I'm Jesse, and here's my co-host, Joel, along with our executive producer, Jay. This week, we're reviewing George A. Romero's seminal 1978 film, Dawn of the Dead, and Zack Snyder's 2004 remake of Dawn of the Dead. Let's get to it.
When there's no more room in hell, the dead will walk here.
Hi all, and welcome again to the very first inaugural episode of Chopping It Up. I'm your host, Jesse, and this is my co-host, Joel. Joel, you want to say a few words?
Yeah, hey everybody.
Just for those out there, there is a third co-host who will be here next week. Unfortunately, he had some personal issues to attend to this week, but he will be back. We are certainly a three-man show going forward. Four-man, counting our executive producer, Jay. Okay, so let's go ahead and get to it. We're going to go ahead and give a quick synopsis of each of the films. Again, it's going to be the 1978 Dawn of the Dead by George A. Romero, a seminal film, Zack Snyder's 2004 remake of Dawn. So it's hard to summarize each year, but as we went back and reviewed the 78 Romero film, we'll start with, runs at a little over 2 hours, 2 hours and 7 minutes, I think, compared to the 2004 version.
Depending on the version.
Yeah, there were several versions out there. It was the director's cut, the extended cut. But the long and the short of it is the 2004 was, I think, about a minute and 40, or an hour and 40 minutes. So much shorter, much tighter, much more compact. So Romero's Dawn starts out in... I had to pull out some film terms, Joel. So it was in medias res. Starts right in the middle of the action. The world is breaking down. It's your standard apocalyptic zombie scenario that we've grown used to. But at the time that it happens, it's pretty novel in 78. So you start out
in Monroeville, Pennsylvania.
I was going to say upstate Pennsylvania somewhere. I imagine everything is just the Poconos. But so it's outside of Philly. And you've got camera crew there is trying to get the information out to the residents. It's all falling apart quickly. A small crew of people escape to a helicopter, and they fly for several nights until they come upon a shopping mall where they decide to take refuge. They find there, of course, a host of supplies and materials that they can use, and they decide to stay there for a bit and sort things out. From there, they decide to fortify the shopping mall and fend off and seal it, fend off from any zombies, where they do fairly well, but eventually a couple of them get infected, and it goes awry when a band of bikers decides to raid and break up the whole thing. And the final survivor, who is the original news broadcaster, she pilots the helicopter and escapes. What's his name, Joel?
Ken Forey. Let's see, it's Ken Forey, yeah.
Ken Forey, yeah, and who is a classic B-movie guy, which I think Romero probably really made him. And then many decades later, Rob Zombie's using him in everything.
Zombie picked him up and put him in the Halloween remake.
The Halloween remake, Devil's Rejects.
Yep. Yeah, he's in Dozer. That's another one.
So, but Zombie was weaned on all the Romero stuff that we're talking about. So that's the really short version for the 78. For 2004, largely similar, obviously. It's the remake. It's not a straight remake. They do give us a few swerves, a few curveballs. But so you start off following a nurse in the ER. It's not really – I guess the apocalypse is happening – but you're not really in the middle of it. Things aren't falling apart yet. They fall apart very shortly thereafter and very quickly. But she starts out in a normal shift, an overnight ER shift as a nurse. Something's not quite right. You're getting a little bit of some oddities with people being admitted and being in the ER and escalating quickly. But she gets off her shift. She comes home to her husband. That's when it all falls out. Their daughter comes in. She's infected. She's a zombie. Infects the husband. They all die. She escapes, gets in her car, and ends up pairing up with Ving Rhames, who's a security officer. They end up running into a crew led by Mekhi Phifer and a couple other people who are on their way to the mall, and they end up in the mall. Again, the same sort of thing happens. They're living there. Everyone finds comforts and food and ammunition and weapons, and they fortify the best they can. And it falls apart similarly there. They decide they want to escape. They can't stay there forever. So they leave in two reinforced vans. Someone has a boat they want to get to, and that crew, they eventually escape to the boat on the dock. They lose some people along the way, and they depart into the middle of Lake Michigan. The remake is just outside of Milwaukee. In Wisconsin, as opposed to outside of Philly on the East Coast. So we do move to the Midwest, which we can circle back to later. I had some notes on that. They escape, and then you give a little bit of a post-credits, during the credits, flair for a peek into what they encountered there. But that's really the summary for each of them. So with the summaries of both films out of the way, Joel, I know you did a little bit of a deep dive into the directors and screenplay writers and things like that. Do you have any facts or tidbits about who and what and where?
Sure. So for the 78 version, like Jesse mentioned, that's George A. Romero and as the director and also the writer, which was the same. Same with the 68 Night of the Living Dead. The runtime for that, depending on which version you're looking at, is right around 2 hours and 15 minutes. The one that's on Amazon Prime, which is where I watched it, it's 2 hours and 19 minutes. I think it's an extended cut.
Much longer than I remember.
Yeah, there's several extra scenes or extended bits. I'd have to go watch the two next to each other to see what. But so the budget was a lot bigger than Night of the Living Dead, but still pretty tiny. It was $1.5 million. Gross domestically was $5 million, but internationally made $50 million, so $55 million. So it was a huge hit.
International?
Even domestically. Like when I talk about 2004 in a second, you'll see that three or four times your budget is considered a pretty big hit.
And not to throw you off, but how much international revenue. I know you talked about, or we mentioned, who is the Italian film director?
Oh, it's again, I'm going to butcher the name, it's Dario Argento. All right, so this is actually a really good, interesting connection.
I believe he makes pasta as well. Is that
so? He actually set Romero up to come over to Rome and write Undisturbed.
Right.
And what's interesting about him is he's the big director for the majority of the Italian splatter films. So like Suspiria, Inferno, there's a few other big ones. But those are the ones, even the modern, I think it was 2015 Suspiria version, he was involved in. So he's a big deal.
Yeah.
He also helped with the music and the international edits. So he was definitely involved in pushing.
He put Romero up. Did you say that? He put him up.
Yeah, he put him up in Rome for a little while so he could work on it. So, I mean,
this I was only bringing that up because I thought, I mean, that's an international influence.
Oh,
there.
Absolutely. He did the Italian translation, or was involved in the Italian translation.
Sure.
And it was a big hit. Like, this time period, that, like, late 70s, early 80s, horror was all the rave in Italy. And that's a, you know, mid-sized market. You can make a lot of money there, and they did. So, you're not wrong at all.
Yeah, we'll put a pin in the Italian horror thing because there's something that once we get into some of the themes and stuff, I want to. I'm sorry, go ahead.
It was also pretty well received. So this surprised me, and he was a bit of a benchmark for me growing up. You know, I respected his opinion, but Roger Ebert gave it 4 stars, the 78 version.
Okay.
It has a meta score. So if you're not familiar, meta score is basically an aggregate of all the reviews that were captured of it, of 71, which is pretty damn high. And it's got a 7.8 on IMDb, which is like, that's customer based, right? Like, so that's actual regular people like us watching it, but it's very well thought of. As you mentioned, it's Ken Forey.
Forey, sure. Yeah.
Okay. And Tom Cervini. Now, Tom Cervini, for those
Savini, who don't know, you're killing all the Italian names. Cervini, yes.
Look, okay.
You're Irish. Not your fault.
He is horror gold. Like, he's royalty. He has been involved in, he's still working actively. He works a lot with, what's his name? You sent me the picture of him earlier today. He was in Machete and
Danny Trejo.
He's involved with a lot of movies that Danny Trejo gets in. And I think they formed a connection from Dusk Till Dawn, which he's also in. If you don't remember, Cerini is, what's his name? It's like Love something. But he's one of the characters. He's the one who has a pistol for a penis in from Dusk Till Dawn. I mean, it's great. It's absolutely lunacy.
But also, Savini, you know, he's the guy when we talk about, I mean, there are certain things that I like or don't like, and the way horror movies have gone into everything CGI now, everything's off your laptop, it's kind of a shortcut, and he was the practical effects guy.
He's one of the big guys.
You saw, he was, God, I put it down, he's Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, he's Friday the 13th, he's several of the different Romero zombie films. He is every important benchmark movie, he's involved in it.
He's really big. Like, he also was, because they had it was a bigger budget, but it wasn't a huge budget. He and one other guy did a lot of the stunts themselves. So he was all over this.
Well, and, in the 78, he's the lead biker. He's the leader of the biker, or at least the most. Right.
The other biker, who's like the leader, who has the SS helmet on, is credited as, like, it's his brother in the film. So they're a brother duo.
Okay.
I forget their name. But and then, of course, he shows back up as the sheriff in 2004.
Right.
One last thing on the 78 version. And this is, again, this is a special effects thing. So I read a bunch about this and actual quotes from Savini where it was the blue skin color, which is kind of iconic.
I noticed that too. Yeah.
So that came from, he really wanted to do like a gray skin tone, so people looked like haggard and and had decayed for a little while. So we did that.
Like us.
Yeah. What's that?
I said like us.
Yeah. Exactly. Just like me in the morning. So, but for whatever reason, when they shot it, it came out blue. But Romero, as we'll talk about later, loved like this comic like kind of tilt to it. He wanted to make things like the theater of the absurd, right? So he was like, no, I want to keep it. He loved the blue-ish color.
I didn't know that.
The easiest one to see it on is the bald Hare Krishna guy in in the mall. Right, his whole, because he's bald like me, his whole dome is really bright blue. So 2004 version, again, like you said, it's nearly 40 minutes shorter, right? Yeah. So there's where all your subtext went, right? Like you just threw that out.
Again, I wasn't concerned with that.
You sacrifice the subtext, but you get a zombie killing truck.
You essentially get an action movie.
Yeah, you get an action movie. I completely agree. One is a horror movie that does some social commentary, and the other is an action movie. And they both have their place. They're both great, in my opinion.
You get the sense, at least I get the sense, not to interrupt you again, but that he's really leaping from one scene to that. He really wants to keep this thing moving. He wants to advance the plot.
Yeah, you're right. And so they have much, much bigger budget. And part of that, so this is a $28 million budget. And they squeezed every penny. Like, they were blowing things up left and right. There's squibs all over the place. It's great, right? Obviously, we've already said that Zack Snyder, but co-writers to this, actually, I think it was more of a consulting capacity. Romero shows up again. He contributed. But James Gunn was also like a writer. So, I mean, that's a huge name, two huge names in today's world that really cut their teeth on this. This was Zack Snyder's first movie he did. Up until then, he had been in mostly the music business and short films. So budget of $28 million, much, much more significant.
How do you get $28 million for a budget with a guy like Snyder, who at that point, like you said, is unproven? My theory is that with James Gunn, who cut his teeth on the trauma films, right? And was actually writing Scooby-Doo Part 2 the same year or something.
No, that's exactly, yeah.
Is that right? Yeah. So
I think you're probably right. But I think it doesn't hurt that Romero had signed off on this himself.
Okay.
Right? Because remember, Romero is still making films. It had been a little while, but he's making other movies. Like, he made Monkey Shine, 1988.
Savini on that one, too, for practical effects.
Yeah.
Monkey
so, Shines, yeah. I mean, like, there's a lot of people that get involved in this. And, of course, the money follows the people. So, budget of $28 million. Domestically, much bigger hit. So it made $59 million, right? So it double, right? And then another $44.5 million internationally. So it grossed 103.5 million. It doesn't score as well with like the critics, right? It's about a 59 Metascore out of 100. But generally, it's pretty well received. Again, the fans ranked it a 7.3 on IMDb, which
I mean, this is
IMDb. That's pretty damn high.
Yeah, and that's because, you know, the difference between like a really good cheeseburger and a really good, you know, steak, you know, the right cut of steak is it's what you want. And I think the critics are going to look at different things that the fans look at. But
yeah, and they probably have in their mind what Dawn of the Dead 78 was. And and if you look at it and you try and say, well, is it that? No, it's not. Well, it's a different thing.
Yeah. Right? And so let's go ahead and, I mean, with those names and numbers behind us, let's roll right into really the meat. So I guess we go ahead and roll right into first impressions, Joel. If you want to talk about, you know, we've both seen these films, but it's been a lot of years for both of us. But so 78, yeah. We're watching.
So 78, and I'll probably just refer to him throughout this as 78 in 2004.
Sure.
But 78 is probably one of my favorite. One of these zombie or contagion movies. It's just spectacular. And if you like that sort of thing, which I do. And I forgot how much I liked the 2004 version. One of the things that you may or may not know is Snyder, a lot of that fast cut, really, really quick pace stuff that he's known for. Well, he was a music director. Like, so he shot videos, right? Like he directed videos up until that point. And so 2004 really has that feel, especially my favorite part, which is the beginning of the movie, right? Mm-hmm. That first scene and then the Johnny Cash lead in that feels like a video, right? It's great.
Yeah. Yeah,
I would say I love them both, but
yeah, I was going to say, Snyder does a lot more work. First of all, he gets a lot more bang for his buck, right? At coming in at about an hour and 40 minutes, he's already giving you bits in the credits, like as it rolls. You know, Romero doesn't do anything like that. He's much more traditional. But you get it before the movie and after the movie. He even extends the plot after they're leaving the boat in the 04 version. I mean, my first impressions, again, it's been a lot of years, but I thought I would be let down. I mean, we talked about this before. I thought I would be let down because I hadn't seen the Romero version since, I don't know, we were teenagers probably, or maybe bits and pieces in between. But
yeah, 20-something years, right?
I started watching it, and I'm looking at my notes, and I'm like, I think I even called you. I was 15 minutes into the 78 version, and I said, this is so dense. I miss whatever subtext was there when we were 17. I wasn't getting it. I mean, we are, I want to say, hold on, we're 15 minutes in. I said, there's the overt racism of law enforcement, right? There's social commentary on poor reporter. So what happens is, before we get into all that, is you start off in the midst of this action in the 78 version, and the government has decreed that in the midst of this zombie outbreak or whatever this viral outbreak is, as they categorize it, there's not to be any private residences anymore. Everyone must evacuate there and go to these safe zones that they've designated. So, of course, you have impoverished, marginalized people of color in a tenement, you know, in Philly, and they send in the SWAT team to extricate them, you know, to pull them out. And of course, they don't want to go. They don't know where they're going. They don't have any money to do anything. And the SWAT team, of course, led by the fat dude with the mustache, who I don't think
Billy.
Old Billy.
Billy's
is definitely from like Massapequa or something.
Well, he landed in my notes big. We made it to 7 minutes and 8 seconds before old Billy drops the first N-bomb.
Yeah. That's what I was getting to. Yeah, so he doesn't care.
He is not subtle. Right?
No, and he wants to just go. And then he does, once they eventually realize that they can't pull him out, he just goes in and goes completely rogue and starts shotgunning people down. So he's not doing any of that. And that's when we get
He wasn't there to help anyone. He was just, you know, killing anything that...
You can tell by the mustache that it's bad news off the bat for Billy. but then that, of course, leads us into I don't want to get too much. That leads us into Ken Forey, but who then, you know, you start addressing the racism, marginalized groups of people, the state, of course, leaning on those people. So you get already, you're 15 minutes in and you've got all kinds of social commentary going on, which I really, really liked.
So one of the things that I think is great, and you're touching on it right there, and I guess we'll just do this now, is that the first exchange between Roger, which is Scott Ranger, I think is how you pronounce his last name, and Ken Forey, who's Peter, Fourier saying to
Fourier.
Yeah, I knew I'd butcher his name.
Yeah,
that'll be a recurring theme, me butchering people's names. But him saying to Roger, "Are you with him?" Referring to Billy, right? Like, and it is very clearly like coded. Are you a racist? Can I trust you?
Well, he still got his mask on and his gun at the ready.
Yeah, he does.
Right, because he knows the deal. But yeah, that's what I was going to say. Well, in any event, before we get too into that. So it's just so rife with text and subtext, and Romero is just throwing everything at you. And so it was everything that I remembered and much more, and I loved it. I loved the 78. I loved it better than the 04. The 04 first impression for me was, you know, I hadn't seen it probably since I – bits and pieces, but we saw it in the theaters in 04, if I recall, together. And it's a different movie, even if it doesn't depart that much plot-wise in terms of advancing the storyline. It's the same broad brush strokes, but he's not concerned with – like I said, he'll throw you a feint at that social institutional racism, or the nanny state, or extrajudicial murders. But like, he doesn't, or
capitalism and consumerism.
He's concerned with telling personal stories. He's concerned with the flair in the aesthetic, the effects, the colors, the flashiness. And that's not a knock on him. It's not a pejorative. Like, he's especially provided where he came from. Like you said, that's to be expected. I think he's a fan, and I think we talked about this, and it's important we get out of the way now, is that I think in any genre, in any artistic endeavor, there's three categories that I like to put them in. There's the creators, there's the innovators, and there's the imitators, right? And Romero's a creator, right? He's an original, sui generis progenitor of the zombie films. And I think Snyder is an innovator, and that's not a knock on him either. That's in music, that's in literature, that's in film. And I think he loved some things about that, and he incorporated them in, and it's a tribute in that way. It's an homage in that way. But he either lacks the ability or the inclination to load it up the way Romero did with
So the first big thing that I think about with the 2004 version as a major distinction is the idea of zombies. So Danny Boyle.
For people who don't know.
So zombies are basically zombies up until Danny Boyle's 28 Days Later. Typically when zombies were presented, or any kind of contagion person, they were shambling, right? They walked really slow, etc. All of a sudden, they were all track stars, right?
Right.
And so that's what's commonly referred to as zombies.
Well, so I actually looked at it. We've been obviously toying around with that as one of the major points. And I looked it up, and Snyder's in 04 obviously is predated by the 02 28 Days Later. But I looked it up, and it looks like internationally, we go back to the Italian film directors, in 1980, Nightmare City was apparently
I've never seen it. But,
so we have research to do, and who knows, that could be another episode down the line. But Nightmare City, apparently in 1980, an Italian film, the very first time they used fast-moving zombies. And the second one, which I bet you've seen, I know you've seen, I've seen it and I forgot about it. It's kind of a goofy – it is a 1985 film, Return of the Living Dead, which has nothing to do with George A. Romero. He had no involvement in it.
You're right.
It sort of positioned itself in that universe with that sort of misleading title, but it really had no connection to anything. There are fast-moving zombies in there, which is the first time in American
cinema.
But
it's been too long since I've seen those.
But I think your point, stands though. And the Return of the Living Dead in 85, they were fast moving, but they were not like Zack Snyder's or 28 Days Later.
No,
they were like rabid animals chasing you down, like frothing at the mouth. It was different.
And they weren't, I mean, don't get me wrong, I liked those movies, but they weren't big hits. Whereas 28 Days Later made a fortune.
Well, right. And once you get to 28 Days Later, and then less than 2 years later, you have the remake of Dawn.
Yep.
From then on,
almost as
often as you get regular zombies, you get zombies.
Yeah, I would say the big steer towards, there's two movies that stand out, or two bits of work that stand out in my mind since they're that are still like the shambling kind, and that's The Walking Dead and Shaun of the Dead. And Shaun of the Dead, same year as Zack Snyder's 2004. So yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the major differences. I think the other thing, and maybe this comes from the music video, maybe it's just the sign of the times in 2004, you end up with Snyder feeling like he needed to bring in a lot more characters. I mean, he introduces five major characters you know, right on top of big three.
And that's a good point. And I think I thought about that too. And I think that's, again, because it works in a sort of an inverse way. Romero only gives you what? Flyboy, mm-hmm. his girlfriend, his pregnant girlfriend.
We can get into that in a bit. Roger and Peter.
He gives you four because he is building and showing you lives, right? Their internal lives. He's showing you what's going on, how they grow, who they are, what they're made of. Snyder's not that interested in that. He wants to throw more people at it. He's got more disposable bodies. They lose half of those people who we don't know anything about.
Almost immediately.
Yeah. Almost immediately, we lose the rest of them en route to the boat at the end as they escape the mall. They're just cutouts in a way. And that's because that's how Snyder operates, right? He's more concerned. It's a fun. There's an old 90s R&B video director, Hype Williams.
Yeah.
Right? And so he did his first major motion picture in, I can't remember the year, but it had DMX, it had Nas, it always did his Belly, remember, and Method Man, and a ton of them, right? And I think it was panned, I'm sure it was panned critically, but, and I've rewatched it since then. Not very good, but every scene, your eyes are just like glued to the screen. It's the colors. It's the mise-en-scene.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful movie.
I don't want to insult Zack Snyder, but he kind of reminds me a little bit of Hype Williams.
There's a lot of that. I think that's true.
The gore stepped up tenfold from what Romero does, and I don't know if that's a budget thing or anything else, but Savini gives you good quality stuff for the time. It's bonkers stuff going on by the time 04 rolls around.
There's nothing I like 2004 a lot. I think it's fun, but there's nothing in the 2004 version that made me go, oh God, right? Like in cringe. Whereas in the 78 one, where the zombie clamps down on Roger's leg and squeezes and bursts the wound.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, that's disgusting. Right. And that's Savini doing his bit.
Which is crazy because Savini is just such a talented guy that like that can do that too. But in 04, in the van, as they're escaping, they take a sharp turn. Things go south. They tilt the van over. They had a chainsaw, which they'd outfitted these trucks to ward off the zombies that were going to be on them through the parking lot and on their way to the dock, some 20-ish minutes away. As they take a turn, they're going fast. They have these chainsaws that can slide through these little slats in the side of the van. They take the turn. The guy is inside with the chainsaw, loses his balance, and just takes this poor woman out at the corner of the crux of her neck and her shoulders. And it's like, it looks so real and it's grotesque. And you're like, oh, this is terrible / awesome. But it doesn't do anything to like a guy squeezing an injured ankle, Roger's injured ankle, as he climbs into the thing and the blood just comes through the sock. And you're just like,
about it's so visceral. I don't know how to explain it. He's just very good at doing it. Right, it's the pop. I think it actually pops when they squeeze it, and that's what made me, you know, be like, I'm gonna barf.
Right? Yeah. There's plenty of gore we can go on forever, but just thematically, another through line I think I wanted to get at was how each movie addressed or didn't address feminism and women.
Yeah.
Right. So Flyboy's girlfriend, who we find out is pregnant, she's at, they don't know, 3 or 4-ish months into her pregnancy, which is on the border of the first trimester into the second trimester. In the 04 version, Mekhi Phifer's girlfriend
is almost nine months.
The third trimester, she's showing, you know, it's going to happen. But we see the only prominent woman figure in Romero's. And the first thing she says is, or in the early going when they get themselves situated in the storage room at the top of the mall, is, I'm not going to be your den mothers. I want an equal vote. She uses the word vote. I want an equal voice in this. I want to learn how to use the firearms. I want to learn how to fly the helicopter, which none of the two SWAT got with, you know, Peter and
didn't know how to fly it. Yeah,
they knew how to fly it, and they didn't even express an interest in, oh, yeah, that could, if Flyboy goes down, we can't get out of here. it didn't even occur to them. She, of course, is the one who escapes first and almost only when Ken Foree decides at the last minute he does want to join her. She's literally in and figuratively piloting the whole thing by the end of it. Right? Yeah. I think that's important.
Yeah, I think it's important. I think it's also, just throwing this out there, that it's also notable that given the time period, right? Like, so with Night of the Living Dead, you're talking 68, 10 years apart, 78 version for Dawn.
Mm-hmm.
Both of the main male heroes are men of color. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And that was like a Romero thing to.
He's just such a funny guy because he said that was like an accident. Like he had someone else cast in mind and, you know, like for Day of the Dead.
For the first one.
For the first one.
Yeah.
That I can't recall his name off the top of my head. He shows up and he's like, oh, I just thought he was the best for the part. Not even thinking about, which is just either Romero is playing us for fools.
And I think that's exactly my point, is that like the idea, it's interesting to me to put all that social commentary about racism and so on.
Yeah.
And then to not really consciously staff that role.
Just
pick the best actor.
Especially in light of, in the original Day of the Dead and in our 78 Romero Dawn, there's white redneck paramilitary factions
all over the place.
And as you referenced, even the biker gang comes in with Nazi regalia.
Yeah, he had an SS symbol on his
SS. So what are we talking about here? And of course, the SWAT team's trying to evacuate the people. And Foree's doing his best to do what he's supposed to do. And Billy from Long Island is gunning people down and dropping N-bombs. So
in one more quick thing, I mean, part of it was budgetary, right? Like why they shot 68 in black and white.
Mm-hmm.
But it was also, that movie's made a long damn time ago, right? Like we forget that's pretty far back. It's just because we're old.
Yeah.
But, you know, that was actually a point I was going to make that I forgot to make earlier. Savini, one of the major reasons he picked that gray color was because it was the original was black and white, and he just kind of liked that.
Go ahead.
No, go.
I was going to reel us back into the feminist thing, and we can move on to the next thing.
Please,
so for the 04, for Snyder's version, Sarah Polley, who's in the lead role, she's essentially the protagonist. I mean, there's a group of them. It's an ensemble thing, but she's sort of the de facto lead for the movie.
She's more or less. Yeah.
We start with her and we end with her. She's there the whole time. She makes it, at least as far as we know. She runs thing there. She has the shotgun in her hands and is operating it within the first, 15 minutes of being around the weapons.
In both movies, the female lead is arguably the most competent out of everyone.
Yeah, it's funny because it takes Romero a while to position Flyboy's girlfriend to get there. Initially, they leave her back in the storage room. She's a liability. Ken Foree says, you're not going to leave until you learn to do X, Y, and Z. You're going to jeopardize us. But she does. The learning curve is steep, but it's fast, but she does it. Sarah Polley, she just has it, right? Snyder's not interested in the backstory, that learning, that's an extra 20 minutes he doesn't want to spend on
the montage. It's a little bit of a Mary Sue thing, but forgivable, right? Like, because you just want to see it. But
so she just is. But curiously, and this is where I really think it is, like Snyder, every other woman present is a cutout. And I don't know if that's just because he's not interested in there are too many people, or he's not interested that much in digging down. But there's the old trucker woman, right? She first drives in.
The old heavy woman who's in the wheelbarrow.
She's literally and figuratively a prop. there is the young, attractive blonde, curly haired blonde who does nothing. She's just a sex object, right? She gets her hair done. She bangs the asshole who owns the yacht.
Yep.
The redhead daughter, who is sweet but has no bearing or drives the plot anyway. They're just forgettable. They're all there for a very specific type, and then that's it. So I we spend a lot of time, you know, with Ving Rhames. We see his USMC tattoo.
Yep.
Right. We see his American flag. We know he's seen some shit. We know he's law enforcement. We know he has a brother that he's trying to get to. We know Mekhi Phifer. We know Mekhi Phifer. We don't know his pregnant girlfriend, who is of some sort of vague European descent. But we can't be mithered to figure out or for her to tell us where she's from or what she's.
She's Russian. And the only reason we know that is because she says, "I want a Russian name for the baby."
Right. Oh, right. Sure. Okay.
That's
right.
The only reason we know. That's the only thing we know about her at all is that she's Russian, we assume, because she's asking for her baby to have a Russian name.
But more importantly, she has no agency. And that's shown to us because he literally has her tied down to the bed.
Yep.
It's forcibly going to give birth because he wants his baby. She is turning into a zombie as that happens, right? So I just thought Romero gives due where it's supposed to be. Snyder leaves something to be desired. But that did remind me one thing, another big difference and through line is the zombie. So the zombie lore and the rules of zombie movies in Romero's, the rules aren't written yet. You're kind of learning
that
they're not sure what happens when you get bit or how long. Ken Forey says, I've seen this happen before. It can take like at least 3 days before they really turn, but they're sort of guessing, right? By the time you get to 2004, the zombies are, you get bit and you're turning inside 60 seconds.
Yeah. And it's like people know that if you, in 78, people don't know that if you get bit, you turn until halfway through the film, right? Like you figured that out.
Right.
But in 2004, it's like they exist in a world where zombie movies exist, right? Like,
right.
Because they all know what the rules are, right? Like they're like, oh, don't get cut. Don't get, you know, blood, their blood in your open wounds or anything like that. It's very interesting that, again, I think most of that is just to fast forward the plot. And that's like a Snyder thing. He just wants to move things along.
So another subject that I did wanted to touch on, which I thought ran through both more so in Romero and less so in Snyder's 2004 version. But I mean, we got to touch on it. Religion, right? God, belief, and all that stuff. So obviously I bet you have the line written down. I think you do. Ken Forey's line initially in the 78 one, when he explains to us, you want to give it to us?
No, you go ahead.
So in the initial 78 one, Ken Forey drops the line on us about when hell is full, the dead walk the earth. I know you have that written down somewhere complete word for word. But he also references his family. It's a grandfather or an uncle or someone is a Wiccan priest or is into Wicca.
Yep.
Did you catch that?
Yeah, he said he was Haitian, which and was into Wicca. And what's fascinating about that is the movie White Zombie, which is where the band gets its name and all of that, mm-hmm. was the first zombie that was actually a zombie film that was made in the United States. And I actually
that's fine, but when you talk about I thought it was interesting that they chose Wicca, which is a pagan religion.
Are you sure it was Wicca? I thought it was voodoo. He's from Haiti, like you were saying. And where I was going is that the first zombie movie that was released in the United States was White Zombie, which is where the band gets its name.
Right.
And that movie was all based on perceived white audience, like thoughts on Haitian voodoo practices, right? And it was very, it wasn't a viral thing, right? Like it was like a magic spell was cast on people, for lack of a better term. And then over time, you get to the 50s and you get to like Invasion of the Body Snatchers, where you start getting alien type ones, and then you get into the atomic scares. You know, like you say, it's funny that they reach back to that history and tie the religious aspects all the way into the 78 version.
Yeah. Right. I mean, I don't think, whatever dispute, you know, it's, whether it was Wicca or voodoo, I think it's either way, it still cuts the same. It's not Judeo-Christian, right? It's not traditional main religion at that time. Especially back then, it was more outside the norm, right? Stigmatized, odd. I mean, vaguely associated with bad things, one way or the other. If people didn't understand it, that's what he references for that. And then I know that you wanted to talk about the priest earlier, who appears. I'll just introduce him. He appears in the tenement at the beginning of 78 when they're still trying to flush out the people from the building. And he approaches both SWAT members.
Yeah, he says this line that I thought was so great.
We have our executive producer Jay has chimed in here, and just like the backstabbing son of a gun he has sided with you. In fact,
he cited the lines.
I know what I heard. Okay, it was so.
He pulled the script. It's voodoo, right?
It was voodoo. It was not Wicca. But again, I think it still stands that what we're getting at here is that it is outside the norm, outside the main. And I think it's curious why he chose that as opposed to, you know, a traditional preacher. Now, what we were getting to was the priest in the tenement.
So the priest says, again, to set the stage, as Jesse was doing, is that the priest is talking to the SWAT team there, right? And so the SWAT team has roughed up and or killed everyone in this apartment building. And they're, I think, in the basement at this point. And the priest, he's got one leg. He's kind of older. He's hobbling through. And he turns to the SWAT team and is talking to them and says something to the effect of, "You are stronger than us, but soon they will be stronger than you." Like, he knows. Like, he is set there as, like, a character who knows that this plague grows. It grows very, very fast.
But he also, that's a good point, but he also has another line after that, and I can't remember it verbatim.
No, go for it.
He essentially gives them a green light to flee, right? There's still some measure of obligation, whether it's in terms of the line of duty, what they've been tasked with doing, or morally or ethically or otherwise, to stay there and try to sort things out. But he basically tells them, get out of here, right? And to me, that's God saying he's the vessel, right, through which God is going to speak, and he's saying he's giving them absolution. It's okay. You can leave this mess behind. You can move on. Save yourselves. It's not selfish.
I think that's right, and I didn't even pick that up on the watching, so that's a good catch. You're right. There are fair. I mean, the priest is not subtle, right? But most of the other things throughout this are fairly subtle references to religion.
Well,
go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say later in 78, there's a nun. So there's that. They keep having a shortcut through the department store, and they have to open up the sliding doors and close them, right, before they get into the mall area. And at some point, Flyboy's girlfriend is behind there, and then there's a nun who is a zombie, got her.
She's in a full habit. Right,
and part of it gets caught in the door, and she releases her real quickly and closes the door back, and the nun stays there for a moment, and they sort of look at each other. So what, you know, I don't want to get too, like, Joseph Conrad in literature, secret sharer, the idea of duels, right, in mirrors. But, like, what are we talking about here? Where am I going to go? How am I going to end up there? Do I get absolution? Am I going to become someone who is blessed by God or the higher power? Or am I fucked? I'm killing people. I'm doing all this not righteous stuff.
Yeah, you catch that nun there. That's a really good one, because I read a couple of different articles where they were talking about that nun as a character. And it's so quick. It's really only 15-second scene. But it's an interesting idea. All of the other zombies that come up to a door like that, they kill.
Yeah,
right.
Sure. Yeah,
they just kill.
Not only does she not kill her, she releases her.
Yeah, it's a very conscious. I'm not killing the nun, right? Even though she's clearly dead, she's a zombie, right? But it was a taboo that she could not cross.
And that we contrast that with Snyder's take on religion, which is, it's sort of a funhouse mirror, and he's sort of someone who again likes to play with this stuff, but doesn't quite know how to or have an interest in, like I say, know how to drill down. So we get in the opening credits, we get Johnny Cash as the man comes around.
Yep.
Right. But for him, like, and we could talk about Johnny Cash lyrics all night. There's a whole separate podcast, but I think it's almost just like, this sounds cool,
right? I completely agree.
Right, because then he takes Ken Foree, who's at that point like a B-movie star. He's the guy everyone, oh man, it's more than he's just like the guy who appeared in the first one. He's like, he's somebody. And he gives you this preacher stuff through TV. Ken Foree portrays a preacher, and he gives you the same line that he used earlier, which was, when there's no more room in hell, the dead will walk the earth, right? Except he's, but then nothing is done with that. There is no, there's no penance. There's no come to Jesus moment, literally, figuratively. I think the closest thing we have to that is Ving Rhames and Mekhi Phifer in the bathroom.
And that gets cut really short. It actually, I noticed that yesterday. It's very like, Ving Rhames gets to have, or could have had, they could have written that scene in a way where he had a moment where he had a revelation, and he's imparting it to this young man. And it is very not that. It's a wasted moment.
Yeah, it's a wasted moment. And that's on Gunn, who's writing it, I think.
But I think that's fair.
I don't know what that scene looks like originally. I don't know how much they cut it up, but Mekhi Phifer says something to the effect of, you know, I feel like I was, Rhames gives him the whole, you saw all the shit yesterday, now you're worried about all the dirt you did, right? It's intimated that Mekhi Phifer, and here we walk back into some ugly, even for the early aughts, racial stereotyping.
Yep.
Like, Mekhi Phifer's got to be a hood dude. He's got to be a gangster. He's got his handgun. He's talking about all the dirt he did, alludes to it. And then Rhames is like, oh, you saw some shit yesterday. You think you might actually have to pay for this. And now you're scared. Go say some Hail Marys, wipe your ass, and God will be straight. And Mekhi Phifer gives him the, you know, I'm here. I feel like I've realized I'm here for a higher purpose. And then he does nothing for the rest of it. He doesn't redeem himself like CJ, the security guard who they first run into in the 04 version, who has a change, right? Who becomes a noble character, who grows, right?
And you're right. He has a great character arc, right? Like, he sacrifices himself at the end. You know, he's telling people left and right to go on. I'll hold them off. It's, you know, he's a really developed character for as brief a time as we get.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why they didn't do that with, like, Mekhi Phifer, like you said. Like, because that is an interesting thing. This idea of, like, I was put here for a reason, he believes, like, to make sure this baby gets everything I didn't get, but the world's ending, right? Yeah. You know, so what does that mean?
Yeah, right. It's left out there. I'm wondering how much in post-production or in editing they really, I mean, it's such a muscular movie and it moves so fast, but maybe they just didn't,
Yeah, it could have been cutting room floor.
Yeah, it's a lost opportunity. Yeah. But I know you had another topic you wanted to bring up.
Oh, I did. Okay, so I thought this was really interesting. So when you watch 78, the people are hiding. Like, our four leads are hiding from the outside world. Mm-hmm. They do not want to be found in that mall, right? They they hide up in the rafters and pull a ladder literally up into like the ceiling. Mm-hmm. So if someone were to happen upon them, you wouldn't see them. Whereas in the 2004 version, they are signaling literally with signs outside saying, help, we're alive, you know, et cetera. And I think that's really interesting. I'm not sure exactly what that says. I feel like it is a you know, post-Watergate, post-Vietnam, you know, cynical, I don't trust the outside world.
I was going to say, is it a hangover from the late 60s, early 70s, hate-ashbury counterculture, of which Romero, obviously, with Night of the Living Dead in 68, I think, right?
Yep.
Don't trust a man, don't trust anyone over 30, and, you know, all that anti-authoritarian, like, or anti-authority, like, is that what that comes from?
That was the vibe I got. I haven't seen anything written about that specifically.
But then that doesn't track because 04, I mean, they start filming in 03, that's squarely in W, right? In George W. Bush.
Yeah.
There is no more like, fuck this, fuck the military, fuck all that, we shouldn't be over there. Like, that sentiment was still
by the time the movie's out, but it was probably written in 02, right? And just like the pace of when movies get produced, you know, written and then made and edited and then released. I'm thinking it's probably in 02, and so that maybe that effect hadn't happened as much in culture. But I still think it's interesting, the difference.
Right. There's a trust there that they trust other people. They trust the government. The helicopter flies over in 04, and they go, oh, well, they saw us. This is clearly a military or government helicopter.
Yeah, they're going to come back and help us.
They'll come back. They'll help us.
Whereas in 78, they were like, no, we're on our own, and we want to keep this to ourselves.
There's also there's some military subtext going on there too. There's like the guy across the street who owns the guns and ammo place, right?
Yes.
Definitely a vet for sure, right? He's a crack shot with a rifle from a million yards away. It's a sniper deal. Ving Rhames, military background, right? Marine Corps.
Mm-hmm.
All these people are trusted and venerated throughout the movie and given the benefit of the doubt. I mean, we compare and contrast them with other characters who are, you know, the other one who's just like, a flunky. Let's see. Jay's got something for us from the 78 one.
I agree. Hold on.
He's letting us know how the sort of slow opening for the 78 for the Romero one is sort of showing us how ineffective and useless authorities were. Authorities in quotation marks, of course. All of those things. And he says media, police, army, et cetera. And that kind of slow rolls into something that I wanted to bring up that I didn't want to forget about, which was a device that Romero uses that Snyder largely shoots, right? Which is, how do we move the narrative along? How do we string this plot together and keep it moving? And Romero does this time and time again in lieu of an exposition, right? Of someone, a voiceover or some other shortcut. He uses the media. He uses, in the first one, in Dawn, he uses the news, right there. You're in where they're broadcasting from.
Yep.
You're getting fed all of the information without someone having to tell it to you. And in cars, in the helicopter, on the radio, on the TV, it is constant. We're being flooded with different media telling us what's going on, where and how it's devolving or what kind of developments we're making.
I love the device. Like, I love him doing that. And, it's interesting to me because, like, the Fourth Estate, right? Like, the press literally breaks apart, right? Like, people are losing their minds in 78, and that's such a cool thing to see in the in a movie like that. The other thing that I don't know if you clocked to this guy, but he's such a strange looking character actor. His name is Richard France. He's the man with the eye patch.
And the beard.
And the big beard. Yeah. So he's actually in another Romero movie that we might cover someday, The Crazies.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he plays a scientist in both. But he's a scientist in this. And his breakdown, where he's just kind of mumbling to himself when they're doing the live broadcast by the end, I just loved that. The idea that, like, oh, the intellectuals are just so flabbergasted by what's going on that they're just devolving into, you know, a mess.
Well, it's, again, it's what Jay was letting us know, is like the impotence of academia, right? You can learn everything you need to learn through a book, but when something novel hits, right? And we saw that in real time in 2020, right? When COVID hit, all the rules went out the window, and those changed, and we learned them just like the characters in these movies were learning. Does this bite mean X, Y, or Z? How long do we have? What is the contagion? Is it airborne? Mm-hmm. And a lot of that stuff breaks down. And now again, to move that from 78 to 04, he doesn't care about that device. In fact, Sarah Polley, when she escapes initially on her way to the mall, she crashes her car. She escapes her house, right, where her husband was killed, turns a zombie. She's driving. It comes on her radio. You start to get the same feed. You get a very Romero vibe. It's for less than 3 seconds. She turns the knob and turns it to a different station. It has nothing to do with anything. It's almost like a conscious about face for Snyder, saying we're not interested in that way. And like I was sort of thinking before, it's like literature, show, don't tell. And I think he's saying, we're not going to tell anything. We're just going to show you. It's going to be a visual experience for you, where for Romero, it was as much visual through Savini's awesome practical effects as it was cerebral and intellectual and subtext, right? And it's more
literary. Like it is more literary. You're right.
Well, I mean, Romero was a guy I have on my bookshelf, which I still haven't finished yet, but he had a sprawling novel that he was writing at the time he died. And when he passed away, the rest of the novel, the last 40-ish pages, I think, were picked up by a friend and confidant who is subsequently a co-author. We're looking at it's like 600 pages or something. It's like a real deal novel. So he has an interest. He's got a literary background. He likes that stuff. He understands leitmotifs. He understands all of that stuff about how building that. But Snyder doesn't do that. He doesn't have that device. He's not concerned with that. I don't even know. I feel like Jay might check me in real time here. They have the access in the 2004 at the Crossroads Mall, right? Wink, wink, nudge, nudge, the crossroads of their lives and society.
Yeah.
It's just like heavy-handed. But they have TVs and all kinds of shit there. I don't think we get much news. We don't get much of anything through that. They're just sort of insulated, and everything's confidential.
In the security office, CJ is watching the news. Like that's where Savini gets his cameo. But it goes off pretty quick.
Yeah, it goes
like,
off.
Whereas in 78, the news kind of like, they just show it going from like a set to like somebody's like barn, you know, like where they still kind of record stuff. But day two, media's dead in 2004.
You're right, Jay. That's right. Because that gets cut to snow shortly thereafter. And then it's like, they don't need it anymore. In fact, I almost feel like, now that you reminded me that, Jay, I feel like, again, Snyder tried to use that just to faint at something. Because I think he wanted to get – that's where you get Sheriff Cavill, who's Tom Savini, as the new – you get some faces. And then Joel, said after him. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, he's a little harder to pick up because he's not someone you see in as many movies. But Roger, the character Roger from 78, his name is Scott – I think you pronounce it Reininger. But he is the National Guard general who does the next thing right after Savini.
Right.
So Savini is the sheriff. Then you have Roger. And then you have Fourier back to back to back. So this – and as you're talking about it, both of you, it just makes me more aware of how much Snyder compressed things. Like, he did his three cameos, right? There are only three cameos in the movie that I know of, and they are all in like a minute and 15 seconds. Like, he just like, we're doing them all now.
He's shoehorning them in, They're just touch points. They're a flash in a Hype Williams video. I know it sounds like I'm so disenchanted with the movie. I enjoyed it for what it is. It is a really really good cheeseburger. It's just not a filet mignon.
It's a fun movie. But I do think 78's very, very good in comparison.
Yeah, and heavy with more of the themes and through lines are the role that the military and paramilitary play in each of the respective films. For me, Romero obviously gets really into the military-industrial complex, right? And again, he's someone who cut his teeth in the late 60s. We have a 10-year gap into the late 70s, but he's still very much now it's transitioned from military and from the SWAT, which he opens with, to the paramilitary. He had that in Night of the Living Dead, whether it's the countryside outside of Pittsburgh in PA, where there's roving bands of rednecks with rifles shooting them up, right? And they kill the black man at the end, the mistake for his own. Then you have the paramilitary grabbing guns in Dawn of the Dead. You've got roving bands of bikers who are like the anarchy chaos agent, right? Slash just
the marauders
used to make things on. Right, they're marauders, but they come out of their it's a bit of Deus Ex Machina, right? It's like, well, we have to get them out of the mall somehow, so this is how we're going to get them out of the mall. And he throws that at them. Snyder, for Snyder, where's the military? Where's the paramilitary there? They're just sort of, I mean, Ving Rhames is a central figure, right? He's a moral and ethical anchor, but like, for me, I can't get rid of like the vision of like the helicopter flying over. That's the government. Yeah, that's the government.
Yeah, that is interesting, right? Like, because in 78, you see the state kind of devolve, like we talked about, right?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas 2004, the state's just absent, right? Like, they're just not there, and that's interesting, right? Yeah. Like, I mean, Snyder is, in my opinion, not a bad director. Like, he's a good director. I mean, most of his movies are not exactly my cup of tea, but he's got a point of view, and he's putting it on the screen. So I got to think stuff like that, where it's that big of a theme. He's making a conscious decision around going, yeah, you're just not going to see the government. They're not going to be involved, right? Like that seems very conscious to me, but I could be wrong.
Yeah. I mean, there's just so many themes across both of them. There was obvious comparisons. They adhered fairly closely to the storyline in each. They chose artistically to go in different directions for a lot of the things that we talked about today. You know, I still love both movies. I have a lot more respect for Romero revisiting some of his old stuff that I hadn't seen in a lot of years. It's watching one of the best poets in the world like put stuff together, and then like watching like a cover band do something, like a really good cover band, right? You want to go listen to them, but they're not the real McCoy.
The only other big difference that I saw that was really obvious was the theme about consumerism and capitalism,
which
was very, very present in 78, right? Like at one point they're like, they both use the line of, oh, why are the zombies coming back to the mall? It's because it was an important place to them in their life, right? Like both 78 and 2004 make that point. 78 really sticks it. And the shopping scene where they go out and shop and they're trying on the watches and they're, Roger's literally yelling like watches, watches, watches. And, you know, they're trying on suits and everything is, they're pouring nice bottles of wine while they drink while they eat these fancy meals. Like, it's all these creature comforts, and they're very, very conscious with
that.
They
build in their storage room that they're staying. They build like an apartment, and it's outfitted, and it looks like a cozy, nice, real place.
Yeah, it looks like a very nice little apartment.
And so, I'm sorry, go ahead. Yeah.
Oh, I was just going to say, in 2004, there's a little bit of that. There's a lit in this sense. The what was the rich guy's name? The guy who owns the boat. I don't remember the character.
He's an asshole.
Steven.
Steven. Okay. So it is notable in my mind that the one rich person is a raging asshole, right? Like, okay, so is that your nod to capitalism?
See, but that's not even
maybe,
Snyder.
But I'm stretching.
Right, but I don't even believe Snyder or Gunn, however you want to slice it. Like, that's not a social commentary on the strata of the socioeconomic status and how he's just a dick. Right,
he's just a jerk.
Right, he doesn't flaunt. He even references the yacht offhandedly. It's not even like he's trying to pump himself up or come up with a solution or be anything. He's just like, oh yeah,
no, he's just making an offhand jerk.
Yeah,
comment.
It's a throwaway line, and they're like, yeah, we're actually going to do that. You have a boat, we're going to use that. But the commentary, the social commentary, consumerism, materialism, America writ large, any of that stuff is largely absent in the 2004 version.
It is. And so you lose all the class elements of things, mm-hmm. right?
Like they faint at it. Mekhi Phifer is a hood. We're strongly intimated that he's a hood. Nothing comes from that. There's no come to Jesus. There's no conversation. They have a nice dinner together that night over dinner, right? They all the long table in the 2004 version in the mall. Nothing ever happens with any conversation with all the characters he fills the room up with. A woman trucker who drives them in. You'd think there would be something there.
Something there if you want to do it, right? And you're right. Like he just doesn't have any interest in that for whatever reason. And so it's a missed point. If you look most of the like synopses you see out there about 78. They will talk about it being a commentary primarily on like consumerism. That was like one of the big themes. Ramiro said he was trying to drive home, and it's just absent.
You would think coming off the heels of 2001.
Yeah.
9/11.
Yeah.
We're only a couple years, few years removed from that. And I remember George W. Bush, of course, saying as the country's falling apart and people are devolving into
your part. Keep shopping, right?
Keep shopping. Yeah. Consume, consume, consume. Don't let the terrorists want you not to buy it. But that's not, that's completely not, it's ignored at all.
Yeah.
At all
you would think it would be, you would think it would be even more clear and present in this film. And it's almost like you can't appreciate any of the themes that we've talked about, right? That are in 78 and are very obvious in 78, like really, really driven home. You can't appreciate them in the 2004 version unless you've watched the 78 version, right? Because they're just not there.
And that's why, I mean, that's the point of chopping it up, right? That's the podcast. That's why we've chosen this, is because we want to see where they went with it, how they did things, and where they came together and where they diverged. But
I had one to toss it. You guys, if you wanted to, in the 78 one, like malls were relevant, and maybe even like new.
Yeah,
and like Romero even had at one point them playing video games, which are also like a novel thing at that time, sort of, you know, as part of the whole commentary, whether it's consumerism or just here's a bunch of things we're distracting ourselves with while, you know, the world is really falling apart around us. Like, why even do a mall, or, you know, what could have been the novel thing to place at the center of the location in 2004, right?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, that is a heck of a point, Jay. It's one of those things where you look at it and you go, the mall, particularly now in 2024.
I follow on Instagram, I follow dead malls, and it's like the last malls. It's before and after, and you're walking through them, and they're just these cacophonous, empty.
And I assume in the year 2124, when people listen to this podcast, you know, at our centennial, we'll be talking about how malls have come back, right? Like, but right now they're pretty much gone. And even in the early aughts, they were dying pretty fast.
Yeah. Oh, well, I mean, it also shows you that Snyder sort of, I think on one of the things that he chose to, I mean, it's, if you're going to do a remake of Dawn, you have to have it in a mall.
Yeah, I think he did.
But he clearly is not like, he doesn't do much with that. Right, aside from them making, you know, caramel macchiatos for themselves or whatever at the stand-in for Starbucks there in the mall, they don't even reference. There's like nothing.
Yeah, but what central building, to Jay's point, what central building would we have in our society? I mean, like maybe a high school or something like that, you know? But yeah, if you're going to do Dawn, you have to do it at a mall.
Yeah. So. Yeah. But I do think we've covered a lot of the themes here. And as we move on to the next section here, we're going to look at what our favorite scene or favorite scenes are. It can be anything that sort of jumps out at you or struck with you the most. Meaningful, could just be fun. Mm-hmm. It could be the scariest, the most grisly, the goriest. I mean, we are in a horror movie podcast, but whatever jumped out for you, Joel, did you have anything noted?
Yeah, for 78, my favorite scene far and away was like the first 15 minutes, that run of like the newsroom breaking down, like the old school newsroom where everyone's got the old headsets on and, you know, everything's breaking down, and then into the apartment building battle. Those two scenes, which I don't really think I would ever watch separately. I would kind of watch. It just flows so well. Mm-hmm. That to me is like the best part of the movie by a country mile, right? Like it's just great. For 2004, again, it's kind of the opening, right? It's the scene with the little girl is creepy as shit. Well, I mean, I don't know why she is just in that house all of a sudden.
I did want to break because you brought that up. Jay, again, he's constantly fact checking, which we appreciate. And I misspoke. It was not Sarah Polley's daughter. It was a neighbor's daughter who came into the house, which God knows how evenly they reacted to that.
How did she get in there?
There's no way you're just like, oh, hey, Susie, what's going on? Oh, no, you're covered in blood.
That was
Susie,
a neighbor child with no face, right?
The opening scene.
So that scene, like the fight to get out of the house, and then, you know, guy gets hit by the ambulance. I mean, everything is just perfect, great, and like so visually engaging. And then you cut right to Johnny Cash, and that song's about the apocalypse, so it's great, right? Like it's just perfect.
Yeah.
So those are my favorites.
Yeah. Well, I'll be honest with you. I don't know how far we are into the inaugural first episode here for the podcast, but all of it, whether it's 52 minutes and change or whatever it is, it meant nothing to me. It means nothing. The only thing that means anything to me is, of course, the last scene in the 2004 version, which you know this about me. I'm a sociopath, right? What I like is just islands, uninhabited small islands. The island that's
long stretches of road and weird islands
that disappear in a linear thing onto the horizon. Islands that are uninhabited. So when the throwaway line in the 04 thing is like, hey, maybe we could get on the boat. There's some islands there. So they're situated just outside Milwaukee. It's adjacent to Lake Michigan, right? So, of course, I spent all the time doing research, not on the movie, but on islands in Lake Michigan. So, judging by where they departed, okay, I'm just getting to the favorite scene here. They've got to be going northeast. There's no islands anywhere else. The first islands that the group of islands that they would have encountered would have been South and North Manitow Island, which at the turn of the century, 1911, around there, was used as a refueling station for ships, okay? So they would have had fuel there. I don't know if it still would have been active, but there would have been fuel lines somewhere that they could have done something with. There was a ranger station, there was a lighthouse, and there's some other things on South Manitow Island, which leads me to my favorite scene as the credits are rolling and we're getting the interspersed, choppy scenes of them in the boat, drifting aimlessly, coming across decapitated heads, and they come to what I presume is South Manitow Island, and they start to get on it, and of course they're overrun by zombies immediately. I know it's stupid. That's my favorite scene because that is an entree into a whole other world that they could have had two different movies on South and North Manitow Island. No one cares about it. I do. That's my favorite scene from the
Oscars. Two quick points. It is a great scene. And it is interesting to me that the two best scenes, because I would argue that's my second favorite, are both like music video style, fast cut, you know, music over the top of them scenes. So that's my first point. Two, you're an absolute lunatic for doing that much research.
Just withhold that for 1 second, because I have one more favorite scene from the 78 Romero version, which again just underscores what a lunatic I am, because none of the other stuff mattered to me. All the meaningful shit, all the materialism and consumer, fuck all that. Like, what's really important is when they leave Philadelphia in the helicopter, right? And they're flying out of the hellhole that we all know Philadelphia to really be. Apologies to all the Philadelphia fans watching. Then they land in like a farm field somewhere, right? And they refuel and they have to kill a couple zombies. They get back in and they're out of there. When they're in transit, right? Like, these big, the draw and the pull for me for movies like this is the interior lives of the characters. And so when you're in transit from one place to another, they're like free. They're in the, they haven't settled down. They haven't holed up in a place, man. You always want to be on the move, and they're in between lives. All of them are in, they're transversing the countryside, the city, and their lives as they knew it and what their lives will be in the future, which is, they don't know what it would be like. That to me is the best. And they're all looking out. They all do what everyone in 1978 would do. They all light up a cigarette and they all stare out the window and they just ponder on what the fuck, what's going on? Is this it? I like that. That's my stuff.
Good stuff.
Well, I mean, that being said, we only got one stage left here as we break this thing down for chopping it up. And that's our meat cleaver, our patented. It is patented. Jay, make sure it's patented. It is our patented meat cleaver ratings from 1 to 5. You can award 1 being the worst, 5 meat cleavers being the best. You're going to do 78 version, and you're going to do the O4 right. version.
Do we do fractional meat cleavers? Like, is it just
I cannot do blade? Math, but I will allow it if that's what you want to do.
All right, so who's going first?
Go for it. You go.
All right, so I would give 78 like a 4.5. I think it's in terms of what a horror movie can do, it does it about as good as it's going to do, in my opinion. Particularly a zombie style horror movie. 2004, I think, is really good, but I would for all of the things that we talked about, I'd probably give it like a 3.5. It's good. I enjoyed it, but it's just considerably lesser. That's all.
Yeah, that makes sense. Because we do share the same brain. I also had the original 78 for 4.5 cleavers. I hadn't really thought about the fractions, but I couldn't give it a perfect 5 meat cleavers. It's pretty close. It does everything you want, like you said, but I'm sure that we have to sort of safeguard that for the best of the best.
I'm saving the fives.
Yeah, I mean, they're out there. They're out there. This is an all-time classic. It is something that if you're into the horror movie genre, and specifically the zombie subgenre, it's a must-watch. It's my favorite Romero zombie film. So I give it 4.5 meat cleavers for the 04 version. You know, I came in rating it higher, and just through the course of our conversation tonight, I had to downgrade it a bit. I realized it lacked a lot of the things that I needed. I gave it a solid 3 meat cleavers. There's a lot more work to do, but it's good at what it tries to do. It doesn't sort of step outside of itself, so I give it credit for that. So 3 meat cleavers for that. Thanks for joining us for the very first episode of Chopping It Up. We had a great time comparing and contrasting both versions of Dawn of the Dead, and we hope you enjoyed it too. If you have any questions, comments, or feedback, please don't hesitate to let us know. You can shoot us an email at choppingituphorrorpod@gmail.com. Again, that's choppingituphorrorpod@gmail.com. Stay tuned for episode 2 of the show when we review Tobe Hooper's 1974 horror classic, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, along with Hooper's 1986 sequel, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre Part 2. Thanks again for listening, folks. We'll see you next time on Chopping It Up.
Night, everyone.
Oh, shit. Wah-ah-ah-ah. Wah-ah-ah-ah. Get up, come on, get down with the sickness. Get up, come on, get down with the sickness. Get up, come on, get down with the sickness. Open up your hate and let it flow into me. Get up, come on, get down with the sickness. You mother, get up, come on, get down with the sickness. You fucker, get up, come on, get down with the sickness.